Are you looking for an affordable and convenient way to upgrade your coffee?
I am.
Well, if a frog had wings, he wouldn't bump his ass so much. Follow me?
What a joke!
Hey, it's time.
You should tell that joke more than once in a movie.
Definitely never needs to be relevant or make sense. It's time to switch to Sparkplug Coffee.
Such a funny movie for this to happen.
Great sequitur, Beth. Sparkplug has always been on the frontier of delivering fresh, premium, ethically sourced coffee to their customers. They offer blends and roasts to suit any taste, including decaf and half calf. But the best part is that they deliver this exceptional coffee to you in Canada or the U.S. within 1 week of custom roasting it here in Toronto, so that it always reaches you guaranteed fresh and at its peak flavor, and you will taste the difference. You can order Sparkplug as you need it, or join the Autopilot Coffee Club so you never have to worry about running out of coffee again. And if you're the type of person who likes to hold out for a better deal, then just use the promo code TOP100PROJECT at checkout for a 20% discount. It's time for your favorite cup of coffee to start coming from your own kitchen. Plug yourself in at sparkplugcoffee.com.
Right. Isn't it? Somebody's Cockney. You gotta say, isn't it?
She definitely learned her accent from Eliza Doolittle.
Top 100.
Top 100.
Top 100.
Project.
And action.
Hi there, classic movie lovers, and thanks so much for filling your ears with episode number 385 of the Ellis's Analysis, the every Monday look back at classic films. We started reviewing old films when we analyzed all 123 of the AFI's choices on their 1998 and 2007 Top 100 lists. Those podcasts were up to their snow-filled ears and spoilers. McCabe and Mrs. Miller will be too. I'm the king of the bathhouse who knows all about money and pain. Money and pain. Pudgy Ryan Ellis. Warren Beatty was never pudgy. I resemble that remark, though. And here's the lady who's freezing my soul, but damn it, she's got poetry in her. My wife, Bev.
That's me.
With those
Isn't it?
With those descriptions were McCabe and Mrs. McCabe. No Mrs. Miller in there at all. But she will come up plenty in this podcast, Julie Christie. Okay, the coming attractions trivia is about Warren Beatty, though, first. So, Warren Beatty played the title character, or at least one of the title characters, in six of his 23 movies. So, Bonnie and Clyde, McCabe and Mrs. Miller, he's one of the two. And how many of those six does his character die?
Four of the six. I say that because I couldn't actually figure out how Mickey 1 ended, but it looks like he's alive at the end, as best I could tell.
I YouTubed it and looked it up on Wikipedia, and apparently he lives through Mickey 1. Yes, and Dick Tracy, of course, who's a comic book hero.
But he dies in Bonnie and Clyde, McCabe and Mrs. Miller, Bugsy, and Bulworth. Wow, spoiler, Bev.
Shot to death each time, too. Bonnie and Clyde, shot to death, of course, famously, in this movie. Bugsy, we're going to talk about that a little bit in this podcast. And also, Bulworth, it's not 100% clear that he's dead at the end of the movie, according to what I saw on Wikipedia. I saw the movie so long ago, I don't remember myself, and I didn't actually YouTube that one. But he is shot, and he wanted to be shot. That's the whole thrust of that movie.
Yeah, he hires his own assassin. Mm-hmm.
So four times out of the six, he gets not only killed, but specifically shot, and most of the time in the head. Not in this movie, though. A lot of back shooting in this film. So the Presbyterian Church Wager, the original title of this movie, and who didn't see box office in that title, was released 50 years ago by Warner Brothers in June. June, for a movie like this, all the cold and snow. June 1971.
Also, it's hardly a summer movie. It's just more of a awards-baity movie.
They weren't quite so obsessed with that before Jaws when it came to releasing a big blockbuster-type action film, whatever, popcorn film in the summer. Jaws really changed that. I think The Godfather was released in February, March, that kind of thing. I don't recall. I don't think that was a December release, though, the first one anyway. But it wasn't so planned the way it is now and the way it's been through most of our lives. So McCabe didn't smash the box office the way that Robert Altman's smash hit MASH did. It was not really a success at all, but it is a classic film. So, Bev, please remind the audience what this classic film is about with the McCabe and Mrs. Miller. Skinny, ain't that? Skinny!
Warren Beatty is John McCabe, a frontier businessman who's setting up shop in a rough little mining town, and Julie Christie is Mrs. Miller, his partner and madam of his brothel. Their success brings them attention of corporate buyers, but when John plays hardball looking for a bigger payout, the company decides it would just be easier to kill him than to negotiate with him. And so John has to live up to his dubious reputation as a gunfighter to take on the three hitmen sent to take him out.
Or, in a nutshell, thank God they put out that fire in the church. It was such a popular place.
Well, it's a pretty interesting thing that you have a popular businessman, kind of like the owner of the whole town. Everybody in town knows he is getting hunted by these three gunmen, and they just let it be. But they go ahead and they save the church that nobody even uses instead. They can't rally anybody to help John, but they can rally everybody to save this church, which is nothing more than a symbol.
John Wayne hated High Noon, as did Howard Hawks, apparently because they thought, no man goes around begging for help. And that's not really what Will Kane is doing in that movie. He's not begging for help. He's just saying, this is your town. I was going to leave. I was supposed to leave before all this, and I'm trying to do the right thing by helping you. But nobody wants to help him other than some kid and maybe one or two people in the whole town. And his own wife at the end helps him out. This movie's got the same kind of thing going on where they just bail on him, and if they'd all banded together, they would have won.
He knows better than to even ask for help. It's worse than them not helping him. He hides inside that church that is so unused that it's not even furnished. Mm. And the minister, who is responsible for building the church, chases him out with his own gun.
Right. My secondary nutshell, by the way. So the cowboy, Keith Carradine's character, dies on the bridge. Such a memorable moment in this film. And Keith Carradine's so cute and adorable in this movie. It's My God.
Yeah.
4 years later in Nashville. That's the same guy? No way. But anyway, he's so cute. And in that confrontation, you feel so bad for him because he's not trying to get into trouble. He didn't do anything wrong to deserve it. But that's probably more true to the way people died in the Old West rather than the standoff in the middle of the square. High Noon, basically. Well, actually, High Noon doesn't really do that so much with the let's face off against each other, big dramatic. Leone did it, or the Old West movies did it. Anyway, the secondary nutshell is that at least Cowboy died without any semen left in his body. He'd been in that whorehouse for days.
You could say he died a happy man, yeah.
So there's a positive thing.
You're really scraping the bottom of the barrel for
kid.
Positivity.
Did not
deserve
it.
And he's pretty beloved, you know. It's such a cute scene that he declares he's going to sleep with every whore in the whorehouse. And then as he's leaving, they're all like, bye, do you have to go so soon? They just love him. He's sweet. He's obviously a good tipper. And...
yeah, they point out he's got a little dick, so it must be that it's about the money. And that he's a nice guy. Maybe he's really good at giving oral to them.
Could just be that he's a charming, sweet kid that they probably thought was fun to have around. And they were happy to make him happy and to get paid to do it. Everybody in that town seems to like him, but it doesn't matter. In the Old West, there's just no justice and no fairness.
A fellow kid who wants to show off what he can do, just dumb luck. It could have been anybody else that came across that. Well, maybe not, but it's because the kid of the three of them, you mentioned the three heavies. Altman talks in the commentary about you've got to have the heavy, the half-breed, and the kid. That's what he keeps on saying in the commentary of this movie. The heavy is Butler, and then the half-breed and the kid. Yeah, sad moment.
And it's just because he happened to cross the bridge moments after the kid failed to shoot a jug that he threw into the frozen river.
That makes up the story that he wanted to float.
Oh, I didn't even want to hit it, but he's embarrassed. His ego is hurt, so he has to save face, and that is the poor timing that kid had.
It reminds me of Lego Movie when Batman has to throw, 15 or 16 different batarangs or whatever you call those things. Yeah, got it, first one. When he has to hit some kind of button or something, but it takes him 15 or 20 tries to get it at all. Same kind of thing. He shoots around the jug, the ice around the jug, many times before he actually does float it. Okay, let's get through the numbers. There's quite a few for McCabe and Mrs. Miller. Rotten Tomatoes, 85% of them said yes. 47 fresh, 8 rotten. The average was 8.7 out of 10, and 87% of audiences. And Roger Ebert and Pauline Kael, two prominent critics in this era, and for Ebert many more years to come, he was still a prominent critic, were big fans of this film. I think it was Ebert's favorite of all of Altman's films. I think he said something about how he made a lot of great films, but this is the one perfect movie.
That's exactly what he said. I reread his review.
Okay. I meant to and didn't. Glad you did.
Yeah.
That year, Fiddler on the Roof, The French Connection, Clockwork Orange, Last Picture Show, those last three we've covered, they were all on the AFI Top 100 list, were hits that year, but this, of course, was not. The only Oscar nomination was for Julie Christie as Best Actress. Jane Fonda won her first of two that year, and she also played a prostitute.
Is it Clute?
That was Clute. And Fonda was probably somewhat winning for a career achievement up to that point, but she was very good in the film, not to say she wasn't. Christie had already won before, 6 years before, for Darling. And I wouldn't say she was robbed, exactly. This movie probably should have had more than one nomination, though, especially for the look of it. McCabe and Mrs. Miller was put into the National Film Registry in 2010, along with All the President's Men, an AFI film that we covered so long ago. Saturday Night Fever, The Empire Strikes Back, and Malcolm X were also entered that year, and we've covered all of those, too. McCabe was 8th on the top 100 genres in the Western, or really anti-Western category. The Searchers, John Wayne, was number 1. Not a movie that you or I loved, certainly not the way other people seem to love it. And this was nominated for the Top 100 Passions and the original 1998 and 2007 Top 100 lists, so the greatest movies of all time, but of course did not make one of those lists. We saw this around the time we saw MASH and then Nashville, when we did the original podcast. That would have been 2015 when we did all of those movies. Maybe the end of 2014 for MASH. I think it would have been, yes. So you've seen this twice, but it's been quite a long time. What are your thoughts on it after your second viewing?
So, full disclosure, I struggle with the first act of this film. It gets a little better in the middle, but I find the first half kind of boring. And then in the third act, it wins me over so hard. Boy, does it win me over. It's so slow to get started, but that payoff, it's so worth it. It guts me in the best way. Comes together to become this really beautiful, thoughtful indictment of the folklore of the American West. It is such a good movie.
Reminds me of the Simpsons scene where Bill Gates comes to Homer's house and wants to buy him out. We're going to be rich, Marge. Rich like astronauts. Okay, buy him out, boys. And Homer's pathetic little operation is overturned. That's how I buy people out, Homer.
I was thinking about that exact episode when I was thinking about this movie. In our lifetimes, we've seen our own version of the Wild West in the sense that there was a time when you could just go out there and make your fortune. And then eventually some people just had enough of a fortune that they could steamroll everybody else who came out there looking for their own fortune.
But relatively ethically, not with murder.
In the Wild West, you mean?
Oh, I thought you meant just in business. Okay,
okay, maybe not with murder. You know what?
Yeah,
I will
right.
actually fight you.
No, maybe. You don't have to. No, yeah. I'm second-guessing myself. I'm sure there have been a lot of killings.
And when I say the thing that happened in our own lifetime, we were alive for the invention of the World Wide Web. And within a decade, companies like Google and Amazon emerging as the most successful companies in this particular Wild West. They're not exactly murderers, I would say, necessarily. But, you know, these big corporations have this really removed version of murder. Maybe not Google, but a car company makes this really cold, removed decision not to recall a part that they know is causing car accidents, yep. that they know is responsible for human death. Somebody who's very far removed from the consequences of these decisions is crunching the numbers and making decisions saying, well, actually, it'd be more expensive to recall than it would be to just pay out survivors of these tragedies. I think that's really what they illustrate here with the Harrison Shaughnessy company. The way that it illustrates the sociopathic incentive structure of all corporations, Harrison Shaughnessy, they want to buy something that will make them richer. But there isn't enough law enforcement to disincentivize them from threatening violence to get their way, so they do so. They've gotten away with it so far. It's the Wild West, right? But first they send their negotiators to try and do it the easy way, peacefully, hoping that the threat of violence will be enough to get their way. And when John makes it just a little bit difficult for them, why would they offer more money? Why should they even wait one day for John to sober up and possibly be more reasonable when it's as simple as saying, we tried, it saves them any more trouble, and it allows John's ultimate fate to serve as an example to any future landowners yeah. that they may want a strong arm.
It's like putting a guy's head on a pike back in the old days, thousands of years ago.
We'll destroy you, and the next time somebody thinks
send
about...
Send a message.
Yeah, the message had already gotten there because Constance, John's partner, is like, what are you doing?
She
just
knows.
Make a deal with
she
them.
She knows what he does not know, which is they will kill you. He's living in denial. Well, Sears, that's Michael Murphy, worked with Altman a lot of times. This is a guy, look at his resume, he's worked with almost everybody, it seems. Such a long career, really good career, character actor. We liked him a lot in Nashville. Just like in that movie, though, when he comes into this one, things go downhill pretty fast. Because in Nashville, he's the one that's trying to organize the political guy to come and deliver that speech that he never does deliver because of the assassination. And this movie, he's doing his job. He doesn't seem like a terrible person, exactly. But would Harrison Shaughnessy, through Sears the Negotiator, have actually paid out that $5,500 they offered? And that would have been it. Handshake, that's the end of it. And really, truly, McCabe could go about his business. I guess he'd probably leave to do something else. And that would have been the end of it. Do you think that they would have done that?
I've kind kind of got the impression that that was what they intended to do. Maybe there would be some fees that they didn't mention or something when they made the initial deal. I looked up what $5,500 would have been worth back in 1902. Now, you can't really easily get data on the rate of inflation from 1902, but you can from 1914. So you have to assume it'd be worth a little bit more. $5,500 in 1914 would be worth a paltry $145,000 roughly today.
Mm-hmm.
So that whole town with mining rights, with his business,
which was booming,
which was doing well.
He was going to get screwed. He wasn't wrong.
They wanted to sell out. One of the many things that makes this film the anti-Western.
They weren't fighting for their own.
They weren't fighting for their own. John and Constance want to sell. They build this business with the intention of turning around and going to San Francisco. They were frontier house flippers. There's nothing noble about what gets them into trouble with Harrison Shaughnessy. It's just John's arrogance and greed. And John tries to weasel out of it in the end.
He tries to
make a deal to save himself from the gunman. He visits the lawyer, isn't really in touch with what his real problem is. Mm-hmm. That scene is very interesting. I really love that scene.
The lawyer tells him what he wants to hear.
Tells him what he wants to hear, but what he wants to hear is, can you just broker me a deal? I'm not trying to take these guys down in court. I'll never get a chance. They're trying to kill me. I would just love to walk away with the money. That would be great. At this point, I regret being so brash when I was stinko.
And when he talks to Butler later on, he effectively says he would take what they originally offered. He doesn't put it in those words. We subtitled this movie. You have trouble hearing movies as it is, mm-hmm. and this movie famously had a muddy audio mix. Altman perfected that as the months in, well, Nashville, I think it's pretty great. MASH, I think, was actually pretty fine. Maybe part of the problem is the rain they actually had there. I don't know. It was still new to him doing this multi-track technique of having, if not everybody, a lot of actors mic'd for sound. In the early 70s, they were asking a lot to make that work well. But he did master it as the years went on, and I think Altman always did it for the movies through most of his career from this point on, obviously. But it's hard to understand what so many people are saying. And you got Julie Christie doing a Cockney accent, and that's hard to understand even when things are completely clear on the microphone.
Yeah, and every actor is doing some level of dialect and unfamiliar slang. So
we had the subtitles on, and I was reading as much as I was watching, which I don't like. I get what Bong Joon-ho was saying at the Oscars, that one-inch thing shouldn't dissuade you from watching foreign films. He's not wrong, but at the same point, I don't want to read a screen. But we did it for the right reasons in this case. And I'm sure he said it, but I was actually watching when he effectively says to the guy who's come to kill him, yeah, I'll take that $5,500, $62, whatever, it's close enough kind of idea. Yeah. Which is a good touch on the part of Altman as a writer, too. So not only the director of this movie, but also a co-writer.
And he's not a hero in that moment. He's a weasel.
He's almost groveling.
Not weasel, but yeah, he's not your Western hero who's fighting for his homestead. He's a guy who accidentally backed himself into a corner and is begging for his life.
And when he first comes in there, he goes out to take a whiz after he's put down his little cloth on the table, and they all come immediately start playing cards, which is a nice touch, a bit of a fun touch there. But when John McCabe goes out to take the piss, Sheehan, so René Auberjonois, who worked with Altman a lot of times, including on MASH the year before this film, is the one, I think, who's spreading the rumors about how McCabe is this great gunman. But McCabe is not a great gunman. And the movie makes that relatively clear as it goes along, and certainly by the last act, you know, that he's not. He's able to shoot a gun, but he's not some Billy the Kid type.
Yeah. Do you think that he killed that guy in the poker game back when he was pudgy?
Well, because he pulls a Derringer on Butler and suckers him in, because McCabe is shot and effectively killed, but he's not actually dead yet. And when Butler comes to make doubly sure, he should just put another bullet in McCabe before he gets even that close to him. But okay, it's a movie. It's a story. You let that go. McCabe pulls the Derringer and shoots Butler when he's pretty much point blank range. Yeah. Well, it's the only close up killing in this whole movie. And I said a minute ago about how they're shot in the back. The Kid and the Half Breed are shot in the back. Again, so opposite of most Western films. The French Connection, the same year as this, the Best Picture winner in 1971, had that famous scene. It's on the poster where Gene Hackman is so obsessed with catching these drug dealers that he shoots a guy in the back. Which is somewhat understandable when you watch the movie in context. It's not so horrendous. I'm sure that John Wayne, yeah, don't shoot a guy in the back. Now you just ruin their careers through your lying bullshit, John. That's different, you know, in your chicken hawk ways. Okay, John. Anyway, Marion. But he kills those two with back shots, and then Butler kills him from afar with a rifle shot. But the only real close-up killing is when McCabe is effectively dead, but he kills Butler with a shot between the eyes.
So there's a scene when he's negotiating with Butler, and Butler is almost toying with him. And at some point he asks, are you pudgy? Did you kill that guy? And he asks him about the details. Somebody's like, do you think he did? He's like, that man never killed anybody. Do you think John killed that guy? Do you think the rumors were true?
I think it's very possible that if he did, it was in the back.
he certainly doesn't want to take ownership of that killing for one reason or another, either that he did it and wasn't proud of it for any number of reasons. Even if you shoot a man to his face, whatever, you could still not be remotely proud of taking a man's life, no matter what the circumstances.
Let's not forget, the kid, when he kills Cowboy, they don't call Keith Carradine's character anything other than Cowboy, so that's why I keep calling him Cowboy, and the kid is just called Kid. So when the kid kills Cowboy on the bridge, Cowboy's suckered into pulling his gun, but not out of malice. But then the kid can just say, he pulled his gun on me, I shot him dead, that's the way it works out here.
But it's obvious bullshit from the start, and
exactly.
Everybody around is watching it is like, just this, you kind of get the impression that the Cowboy is like, there's no way out of this conflict. He knows that he is doomed the second he sets foot on that bridge.
Right.
There's nothing he can do to stop this kid.
But
from
in their world,
him.
What the kid does is moral because it was face to face, and the kid.
Nobody
cowboy,
believes that, that what he did was moral. They just believe that he did enough theater.
In Western cliche, it is.
Oh, right. Okay. Now, that's, again, what makes it an anti-Western. Because his behavior is deplorable. This notion that gunmen were all honorable and all did it face-to-face and all
high noon.
10 paces and turned around. Of course that wasn't true. This movie is so brilliant in the sense that it is the real dirty frontier.
Mm-hmm.
And it is dirty. And it is so evocative. You really, really feel like you're there. They went to a ton of trouble to give it verisimilitude.
They came to Canada.
They came to Canada. They wanted to make it so real American that they shot it in Canada.
Vancouver and Squamish.
But Vancouver and Squamish, it looks like Oregon. It looks like Washington State. Mountainous, green, and rainy. But they built that town. They just picked a location and they built it. The crew lived in those huts that they built. And when they built it, they used only materials and tools that were available at the time. The crew that was there just to build the sets, they just put them in costumes. And they were like, go to work. And they would shoot around them working.
Do their job. They're actually building a town in the movie,
but
so why not
like,
make these guys
exactly.
be the ones building the town?
It's so cool.
Mm-hmm.
They go to so much trouble, and one of the things that Altman does absolutely best is he creates these worlds that feel really familiar and believable and authentic. You've got the two titular characters. They're just two of the stories. Well, there's one of the stories that we come in and out of. The film seems to almost arbitrarily drift from one story to the next, often just pausing for a beat to enjoy a moment that has nothing to do with the plot.
Should I shave my beard?
Yes, should I shave my beard? Or I think so much about that extended sequence of the drunk miners playing fiddle and dancing on the ice. It goes on and on, but it feels like a moment that you would have seen. Humans being human in a way that's really universal and everybody's experienced something like that. And this is just how Altman tells stories. They're less like traditional narratives and more resemble what it's like to just simply be around people and knowing people. In real life, we come into the middle of people's stories and we leave them before their stories are concluded. He drifts in and out of these people's lives. And it also gives us this really rich sense that each of these characters in the film, even the small ones, have real backstories, lives lived that we're just simply not privy to.
Altman let them develop them themselves as well, the actors.
They really feel like real people. They all have these individual personalities, and you peripherally get to know them as if you were living in a town and seeing the same people over and over again and getting an impression of them. So when something happens, like the kid shoots the cowboy in this very dishonorable way that is totally like a cold-blooded, spontaneous murder, you think, well, that's probably how they all really went down.
Well, I said High Noon a few minutes ago, and I didn't mean the great movie High Noon, where, yes, things happen at that moment because that's when the train comes. But one of the great things about High Noon, and that John Wayne and Howard Hawks, as smart as they, well, at least Howard Hawks was smart, didn't get, it is a gunfight. But they're not standing opposite each other. And I love Leone's films, but it's not.
Mm-hmm.
And they all have a chance. Okay, right. Let me get
their
my breath.
Hands hovering over their guns.
Okay, you ready? I'm ready. The point is, there's time to get ready and get set. And it's completely fair. No one can claim that they weren't ready for the gunfight. But in High Noon, when they do have the big clash, it isn't like that. It's just that it's set at High Noon. Some of the best Westerns that we've both liked so much have not gone down that John Wayne path. Even The Searchers, which is very flawed. People overlook those flaws because they love the movie so much. Some of the great shots, some of the great inspirations. Excellent ending, for sure. Some terrible subplots. This movie has no bad subplots. We talked a minute ago about the guy with the beard, and you said about the people dancing on the ice. When the people are dancing, and then they wouldn't even call it a jukebox, whatever you called it back then.
As a music, yeah.
Stops making music. They all stop and look at it, like, what's going to happen? And it plays again, and they just start dancing
it's
again.
It's like a wind-up music box, which makes me think, oh yeah, once upon a time, a music box like that that we all treat like a trinket would have actually been one of the very few ways to hear recorded music. They have the guy that plays the fiddle, and they have their music boxes, but they certainly didn't have record players, so they have to actually fire that up so that they can just keep dancing, which is what they want to do.
In a lot of movies, you wouldn't see scenes like this, but Altman loves the background players as much as anyone else. He doesn't have a problem casting ugly people either.
Or at least not looking people.
He's got two of the best looking people who've ever been in Hollywood in his two lead roles. And I've mentioned this book many times in this podcast, but not for a while. Easy Rider's Raging Bulls. McCabe and Mrs. Miller has talked about a lot in that book. Beatty and Altman clashed a lot. And according to that book, Beatty said to Altman at one point, "I'll deny it if this ever gets repeated, but this movie is about me and Julia as stars first and everybody else second." Which to some degree is true because they are clearly the main characters.
Yeah, I mean, isn't that true? But every movie?
Not every Altman movie. For example, Nashville. There's no one clear main character in that movie.
Okay, fair. And same with MASH.
Mm-hmm.
But in this movie, he's right. The movie's named McCabe and Mrs. Miller.
But I bring it up because I bet that Beatty didn't like the final cut, and maybe even during the shooting, that so many scenes are with the bartender, or with this character, or with that character, and not about his story. The movie's 2 hours, and you said a few minutes ago that there's a lot of stuff in the beginning that you didn't love that much.
I liked it fine, it's just boring.
But the last half is the best part. But that's also a 70s thing. Movies were slower back then almost always, even the great action films. Look how long Jaws gets to really get in it. The opening scene, of course, is so classic, but there's not that much shark action. We know why that happens, of course. Star Wars is not the fastest-paced movie of all time either. That was many years after this film. So that's a bit of a 70s thing. Things have just changed. But I bet that Beatty did resent, if that story I read was true, that we saw so much of these character moments that do make a movie like this stand out so much more than it would have otherwise. Nashville's got a lot of the same things going on. We didn't love MASH. I can't think of an example right now, but I'm sure that some of the better moments in that are not with Elliot Gould and not with Donald Sutherland. And speaking of Elliot Gould, that's who Altman wanted to play McCabe. This is one of the best things Beatty ever did in his career. He only made, like we said, 23 movies in all these years of acting. He's had such huge gaps when he hasn't acted at all. And now he's in his 80s. He's probably not going to act again. He did make that Howard Hughes movie a few years ago, which no one saw. I saw it and don't remember much about it. A lot of old friends were in it, and it's certainly well enough made. Beatty was a really good producer and sometimes director, certainly actor. But as good as he is in this film, and as good as Christie is in this film, I would have loved to have seen Elliot Gould and maybe not Julie Christie, and I'm a big Julie Christie fan. Dr. Zhivago, wow, one of the best looking women I've ever seen in any movie is her in that film. But when we saw it again for the podcast, I noticed that she's not nothing. She's not just the beautiful object that everybody wants. She fights back against Rod Steiger when he tries to take liberties with her. Her scenes with Omar Sharif are not as good, actually, as some of the scenes with Steiger, even though he's the one that's taking advantage of her and abusing her. But in this movie, she's not that stunner. She's still pretty, but with that weird haircut she has and everything, she actually looks more like an ordinary person. Beatty, despite the beard and the fact he's muttering all the time and is often dirty and everything else and drunk constantly, is still Warren Beatty, so he's beautiful. Well, you've seen some of Warren Beatty's movies. You and I think have only covered now, too. I don't think we've ever covered anything other than Bonnie and Clyde with him. And with her, I think it's just Dr. Zhivago. Both of those made the top 100 list. What do you think of them in these two main roles?
Julie Christie, I've only ever seen in one other movie, and that was Dr. Zhivago. I think she's good. I agree with you that she's beautiful. I love that she really digs into being vulgar and not tomboyish, but classless. It's funny because her appeal to men is her entire business, and she just seems to not care. She doesn't need to care. When you're this deep in the frontier, you could look a lot worse than her. So, you know.
Her girls do.
Her girls do. But
they are not hot. Yeah,
that's why she charges, you know, $5 a romp. Warren Beatty, I've seen plenty of Warren Beatty movies. He always seems like a guy who looks like Superman, but actually is secretly, truly Clark Kent under that big burly man costume is somebody who is deeply faking it.
And vulnerable.
Vulnerable, barely pulling off the personality that everybody attributes to him because of his looks. That is the impression I get very much in his performance as Clyde Barrow. He's a person who's kind of faking it. He's trying a little too hard.
He's impotent.
He's not totally pulling it off. Yeah, secretly he's impotent. Secretly he just doesn't really know what he's doing. That really comes through here, and you're watching him kind of self-destruct. He's drinking too much. He's making brash choices.
This business is not his. It's Mrs. Miller's. It should be Mrs. Miller and McCabe.
He's like the type of person
he's lucky
who
he's even in the billing at all, if you think about their business, because this wouldn't work if it weren't for her.
In that time and place, it's almost as if he should have been born a beautiful woman instead of a beautiful man, because he would have been much more comfortable in the role of letting her take charge and her be the one
she who tells him we're partners.
She tells him, yeah, yeah, no, it's so true. And he just seems
she's
helpless.
She's not suggesting, against, she's not asking, yeah, yeah, exactly. She's telling him.
He's actually better in that role. everybody goes to him and assumes that he's the face of the business. But the fact is, she's the one that's in charge, and that's how it should be. It's almost as if he should have the more subservient role. He truly is a beta in an alpha's body. Even in something like Dick Tracy, there's a fallibility to his confidence in every part that he plays, no matter what. It works excellent in this film. I would have loved to see Elliot Gould in this, too. I don't think he would have done better. I think it would have been slightly different, but I think he certainly could have pulled this role off as well.
Mm-hmm. Well, you mentioned some of his other roles a minute ago, and I said we're going to talk about Bugsy. The end of this movie, while the townspeople are trying to save the church, they don't even care about in the first place. And like I said to you during the screening, if it did burn down, it wouldn't have affected anything else. It was nowhere near anything.
Yeah.
It's not like you had to worry it was going to affect this building and that building and spread, like the Chicago fire or the London fire, that kind of thing. But much like in Bugsy, he built a town. And this probably more Mrs. Miller, but he's credited for building a town in Bugsy. It's Vegas. It was his idea to make Vegas at all what it became, but then dies prematurely, murdered, and others reap the rewards. He's by no means a hero in either movie because he's a flat-out gangster in Bugsy, but because we follow him like we do in Godfather, like we do in Goodfellas, and so many other villain movies, we've talked about this in Public Enemy, you identify with the guy you're seeing or the woman you're seeing on screen the whole time. It's hard not to side with a monster. Charlize Theron, one of the great performances of all time. We shouldn't like her, but we're with her the whole time. So you have to somewhat like her because it's a great performance by a good actress, great actress. So you're sort of even with her. In the case of Bugsy, one of the kinds of characters he often played, maybe always played, that you just talked about, Shampoo, has a tragic ending as well. He's a bit of a dumbass in that movie, but looked as beautiful as he ever did, with a lot of beautiful women as well. He's a hairdresser. But that movie is about so much more than it might seem on the surface. I like Shampoo. I haven't seen it in a long time, but the second time I saw it, I didn't love it the first time, liked it a lot more the second time, partly because I saw the vulnerability and with a very sad ending as well. Not as tragic as this movie. Bugsy too, though, because you've watched 2.5 hours of this guy, you're basically with him and he gets his eyes shattered, I think. But anyway, he's killed in his own house. And then they show at the end, Vegas became what Vegas became in 1991. And look what it is now. Not so much last year, obviously, with the pandemic and now this year. But look what it became. And it was his idea. It probably wouldn't exist at all like it is now if it weren't for Benjamin Siegel. Beatty seems to be drawn to these kinds of characters. Maybe that's why he doesn't do very many movies. He wants to find a character that seems just right for him.
Oh, so when I was doing research for this film, I came across this old Dick Cavett interview with Robert Altman. There wasn't really that many gems in it, but the one really interesting observation that Altman made, Julie Christie always seemed to get it on the first take and didn't need to do more takes, but Beatty got better with every take.
And wanted to shoot a lot of takes.
And he wanted to shoot a lot of takes. And he says that it was because he always had to overcome his embarrassment at what he was doing. You know, when you're an actor, some of the things you do are embarrassing. You're Julie Christie, everybody looks up to you, and then you have to do this ridiculous Cockney accent. It's a special kind of person that can let go of how they perceive to the people on set and just get into that character and not worry about it. And he struggled to get into that headspace. And he said, I'm not sure that Warren Beatty really wants to be an actor. I think he wants to be president.
That fits. He's a very political guy. He's been.
Yeah.
We don't hear about him the way you hear Michael Moore always yaps off. And I like Michael Moore's politics, but he does yap off. Susan Sarandon, a lot of people are very vocal about politics. We know where they stand. We know where Beatty stands, too, if you've paid any attention, but he's not as out there as you might think other people are. But he was a big supporter of McGovern against Nixon. And, of course, McGovern got trounced by Nixon, but that wasn't Beatty's fault. He was trying his best to get the liberal elected president. He's been in the liberal side, I think, every time. I could see that about Beatty, wanting to be more political. Pauline Kael, I mentioned her as being one of the people that loved this movie. She loved probably everything Altman did. She raved about Nashville. She raved about MASH, I think. Beatty hired her, this is also in E.C. Rider's Raging Bulls, to do something, I forget what it was, some kind of executive role, some kind of consultant role. And the speculation from a lot of people at the time was, if we hire her here, she can't be a film critic and ruin our movies, because she was influential, like Ebert was, well, more so than Ebert was, I would say. But she was so influential that a lot of people thought he did this just to keep her from ruining movies, and then he fired her. His expression, according to that same book, was killing. So if I was producer on McCabe and Mrs. Miller, I would have killed Robert Altman. You read that and think, Jesus, it was that bad? But no, that's what he said he did to Kael when she was working with him through Paramount, maybe, or something like that. He killed her, but he meant he fired her. He would have fired Altman if he could have on this movie. And I think his biggest problem was twofold. One was he didn't love that he wasn't as much of a focus as he wanted to be, even though he and Christie are certainly the main characters in this film, but also because of the audio mix, the audio problems. Altman apparently blamed the editor on that. I don't know if it's the editor's fault. It'd be the audio man's fault, if anything, or the director of the whole film. You don't blame the editor on that. If you do throw the subtitles on, it does help you. This is a movie, though. You don't have to hear what they're saying all the time. Beatty's mutterings to himself, though, are fun. Money and pain. Money and pain. And freezing my soul. And some of the things he's saying to himself. I love the scene before he goes off to meet the lawyer, where you think at first he's talking to her in the room, but then you realize as the scene plays out, she's not sitting there. But it's that thing we've probably all done, not usually out loud, but he's arguing with her, but she's not there. It's the conversation he wants to have with her, or the fight he wants to have with her, but he knows that he won't win it. He's probably too much of a coward to have it in the first place.
Who could fight with that woman? She is formidable.
Right. But he's arguing with somebody who's not even there.
I got poetry in me.
I got poetry in me, damn it.
I love that line.
Yeah, some of the best scenes that he's ever played in any movie are in this one. And he plays such a loser. If he didn't like this movie, I got to question, at least in this one case, his taste, because it's not the movie I'll come back to from Altman the most. Nashville is. I've talked about that plenty of times in our podcast. I love Nashville. When we saw it for the podcast years ago, because I knew where it was going and you'd never seen it before, I didn't want to tell you anything that was going to happen. But I'm watching all these hints about where it's going to go with the assassination at the end. I could barely contain my tears. I said, just stop him. Just right now. You can stop the guy who's going to kill whatever her name, Ronnie Blakely's character, Norma Jean, I think is her name. You could do it. Oh, you could do it. But of course, no one knows because they don't know he's going to do any of these kinds of things. And that movie touches me so much. This one may be objectively better for a lot of people like Ebert, but not for me, partly because of the audio problems that you have to throw on your subtitles to hear what they're saying in the first place. It doesn't look bad unintentionally. It's supposed to look muddy, and they call it the pre-fog filter. So Vilmos Zsigmond, who shot some of the movies we've covered before, Close Encounters of the Third Kind, The Deer Hunter, also Deliverance, the first two were AFI films. We've covered all three of those, though. So they did a pre-fog thing and filters, which was intentional to make it look this way.
And they did it like that with filters, where they did, like, I think a wash of the film before they even shot it. They did it because they were like, we have to do it in camera so that the studio can't tell us not to do it.
Because they would.
Because they would have, yeah. We have to commit to this, otherwise the studio is going to fight us. And we keep talking about post-production. This film spent three times as long in post-production as it did in production.
Well, the audio, no wonder.
The audio, yeah. They actually did it in Vancouver, which I don't know about the 70s, but I know that now that would be a really unusual way to work. They spent roughly 3 months on set and 9 months in post-production trying to make the audio work. As an editor, the thought of spending 9 months trying to make messy audio recordings work seems like my worst nightmare. And the way he shoots it is that he just has all these microphones and they're all picking it up simultaneously. It means that as an audio editor, you don't have any control. If you're trying to cut a sentence and make it shorter or cut out a line here or there, something like that, and if it's going to interrupt a conversation that's happening in the background and make everything sound really choppy and miserable, you're out of options. No wonder it took 9 months. I can't imagine how on earth they made this work.
I have to interject. Give it up. You're out of options. Whoa. Speed reference.
Okay.
So you're out of options.
As a person who's been very frustrated with the choices that people on sets have made, well, this is how I want it, and they'll just have to fix it in post. Well, I'm the one who fixes it in post. Fuck you, Altman.
Shit going in is going to be shit going out. Sometimes you can work magic on it.
Well, they did work magic on it. I mean, they did their best, and I know it's not perfect. And it's not just the audio. I know that they had to do a lot of working with the different storylines. They shot so much material, and they had to decide how to interweave them, and at some point they had to decide to spend 2 full minutes on a guy dancing on ice with a fiddle playing, a guy deciding whether or not to cut his beard. There were lots of moments like that, and they had to give it a flow. Despite complaining about how it took me a little too long to get into this movie, I wish it was a little more entertaining from the jump, but I wouldn't say that there isn't a flow. I think that if you have a little bit of patience, it pays off so well because everything feels so completely like it belongs. 9 months in post-production really did create this story that just has such beautiful uniformity and leads you to this place that you didn't even realize it was ultimately taking you. When you get there, it's so worth the journey. That is not easy to do, and especially when you are working with technical problems, and I'm presuming working with a lot of footage and a lot of options, and obviously a very fussy director who had time to ruin your life.
And a star who was probably interfering a little bit in post-production. It's interesting, the first thing we hear when you see the vanity credits at the very beginning, the Leonard Cohen song, of course, playing. You got three Leonard Cohen songs, and they also play A Christmas Carol, It isn't obvious. If you listen, you realize, I think it's Silent Night or one of those. But otherwise, that's it. There's no score in this movie. It's just Leonard Cohen songs.
There's like the fiddle player, and then there's the music
okay,
box.
That's diegetic. I'm talking about stuff outside the movie.
There's lots of silence.
The 2001 thing where there's no score. It's just, well, maybe there's a little bit of score in that, really. But it's mostly the classical music. In this case, it's Leonard Cohen. But the first thing we really hear, though, sound effect-wise at least, is the wind, which is very appropriate for this movie. And the first thing we see is McCabe on horseback, and he's alone. That's so important because he starts the movie alone and he ends the movie alone. So he comes into town. I've talked about in Jaws. I don't know if Jaws has come up today, but it is. Where he's almost like a gunslinger coming to town. I'm going to come get you, Sheriff. And at the end, it is a mano with the sheriff. Smile, you son of a bitch, as they face head to head. But it's in water and it's an animal rather than a gunfighter. In this movie, you got McCabe coming to town on a horseback all by himself with aspirations of making it big. It's Sheehan that's spreading these rumors that he's this great gunfighter. But then even before any of that's even said, those guys crowd around him immediately, maybe because he's a good-looking dude. I don't know. Maybe they're all gay. I don't know.
I didn't totally understand that scene. You're excited he's there because now you can finally play poker? What was stopping you before?
The red cloth. They needed class.
Oh, a cloth. Finally, we can gamble.
But also in that opening scene, you see rain through the whole movie and mud and obviously snow at the end especially. But the teeming rain. Now, we know about rain machines in movies, and maybe they use them for this one. I didn't read anything about that.
They did.
But, okay, there you go. Because it is coming down hard. Even I, with my bad eyesight, couldn't miss the fact that it is beating down and sideways on all these guys in the beginning of the film. We've all been through that. It's probably the worst one, because it just hits you in the side. You can't block it.
Yeah, you can't protect yourself from it.
And so it sets the tone right at the beginning. And McCabe is alone then. He's alone at the end. And even when he's with Constance, Mrs. Miller, when they click here and there... It's funny this movie's nominated for the passions list because he has passion for her to a degree. He obviously likes her. I think he wants to be with her. He'd maybe marry her. But she's always pushing him away. He has to pay to have sex with her. Maybe at the end, that last time they're together, he doesn't. But otherwise, he's always paying for it. And also, when she mentions about, do you know how to check for boys who have the clap? When she says that to him, I thought I saw him look down at his crotch to say, oh, God, I do. But then she sleeps with him, so he must not have it. But I took a note thinking he must have the clap because Beatty doesn't look. Maybe it's just a comedy moment, as if to say, oh no, she's going to discover me having this now.
Maybe he's recovered from the clap, and it's one of the things he's embarrassed about.
That could be.
So he loves her. There's no doubt about that. And it's boyish. Doesn't he just seem like a kid with puppy love? I guess I've just never cared about anybody this much before. And she's like, you don't need to talk.
Right, because for them to have sex, he's got to pay for it, and she's got to be high.
She seems like a character who maybe once upon a time had a heart, but just to survive in this world... She had to extinguish it. And this is the person that's left. She is tough as nails. I don't believe that she's a bad person. I don't think she's immoral. She's not like the kid, somebody who could just kill indiscriminately. But she is somebody who's had to shut off that part of herself. And she is a Mrs. That's a curious thing to me. She's not Miss Miller. Implying that there is a Mr. Miller somewhere. And we never learn what happened to him, what her origin story is.
Maybe why she knows what's about to happen to him is because it happened to Mr. Miller.
Why she would keep that name, Mrs. Miller, is out of this enduring love and grief over whatever life she had before she wound up here. But she is a person who has learned how to survive, and you don't survive by feeling sorry for sweet men who are puppy love in love with you when you have a mission, and that is to make your fortune and move to San Francisco.
And of course, the funny thing is, Christy and Beatty were dating at this point. They never got married, but they were pretty serious for several years. I read that in Heaven Can Wait. She does some kind of cameo in that or something. Or maybe she's in the movie more than I haven't seen that movie in a long time. There's a scene where the two of them are walking and they do it where it's MOS. It's going to be a song playing there.
Meet out sound.
It doesn't matter what they're saying. And apparently what she's saying to him with a smile on her face is, you're still doing shit like this, Warren. And Heaven Can Wait's not shit. It was very well regarded at the Oscars with all kinds of nominations. I think it was a successful film. But they were friends enough that he could work with her after they'd been together. But I like, in a way, knowing that they were together during this movie, and at the same point, she's almost always like a running back in football, stiff-arming the opposition to avoid tackles. She never really lets him in. We don't really get to know much about her at all. So again, I like the performance, and I'm not against the Oscar nomination for it. But it's such a different thing from the Dr. Zhivago's and The Darling, where she won the Oscar in the 60s, and then even away from her... Where she's also a bit of a stiff-armed kind of character, but she's got Alzheimer's, so you can understand that a little bit more. She's one of those kinds of characters in a very good movie, maybe even a great movie, where we don't really get to know almost anything about her, which is maybe true about McCabe, but it really seems to be true about her. And I said it a minute ago, but it shouldn't be overlooked that this woman is a drug addict, and she's doing what happens at the end of From Hell. I'm sure other movies have done this too, but Johnny Depp's character goes through an awful lot of things in that movie. And at the end, he's in a foggy haze doing whatever it is they do in that movie. But I think it's the same kind of drug as this.
Which is opium, which is just heroin.
Yeah. You know? So the last shot of the movie, I think the very last shot of the movie, maybe it's of actually Beatty in the snow. But the last time we see her, at least, is she is just passed out sideways, laying down. Bit of a blissful look on her face. Probably knows what's about to happen to him, but doesn't know what happened to him
yet. I get the impression that she's doing that because she knows he's going to die and she just can't tolerate the tragedy of it. We always do a what happens next. I'm so curious. I genuinely don't know what would become of her because she's his business partner, but she's a woman and it's 1902. And are Harrison Shaughnessy going to offer her $5,500?
No.
But who are they going to offer the money to? Because just because they've killed McCabe doesn't mean they suddenly own this town. That's not how it works.
Ah, oh, Bev, may I pat your head?
I don't like it when you do that.
That's what's going to happen. I do have a what happens next, though. They find McCabe's body in the spring and ride his body down the mountain like it's a sled.
Oh, no.
Like that Murder Horn episode? Yes, where rides the frozen guy. That's the only what happens next I actually have. I don't have a serious one because the serious one, actually, I'll say it right now, is what I just said to you. This company is going to overtake this town, and maybe they'll make it a great town. But much like Beatty's character in Bugsy, this was his idea. This was his... other people contributed to it, of course, too. But it was... his creation, more Mrs. Miller's, okay, in this case. And yet other people are going to take credit for it and build vast fortunes. There's such potential in that town, and that's, again, the Bugsy in Vegas thing, where there's so much more they could do with it. And he's killed for all kinds of good reasons, probably justifiably so in that movie. In this one, not so much. You feel bad for him. In Bugsy, you don't really feel bad for him, exactly. And they wouldn't have known when he was killed how much Vegas would make only a matter of years later, let alone as the decades rolled on. But he should have gotten more out of it than he did then in that movie, that character. And this one should have got more out of it than he did, too. And if he'd taken the money they offered to him, I don't know. I'm not sure they would have been good on that money anyway. Michael Murphy is a very honest-seeming actor. But was it Hollander, who's his buddy? Played by Anthony Holland. So he plays Hollander. He's not cutthroat exactly, I wouldn't say. But he's not as nice as Michael Murphy is, either. And McCabe isn't stupid, but he is naive. And maybe he's a little bit dumb, too. But he's not flat-out stupid.
He's a little bit dumb. I like how Sears and Hollander, they don't come across as evil or malicious. They're just cold and efficient. They have no reason to care more about McCabe's life than they do about Harrison Shaughnessy's profit margin. So how is their choice any different from an exec who decides to raise the price of EpiPens? This movie is the anti-Western, it's the anti-Western folklore movie, and the anti-American folklore movie, this notion that somebody could just go out and make their way. But they can't, really. When you take laws away, the free market ruins people more than it lets people build up their own fortune and livelihood.
Well, we had rampant farting in the lighthouse. Now it's a bunch of burping from McCabe. He's burping like Rick from Rick and Morty. And Beatty, even though he looks great in this movie, is definitely playing a loser. He's always drunk, like
I said
before.
Yeah, he's kind of a doofus.
Mm-hmm. A twit. Yeah, it's funny that he would let himself look... I wouldn't say bad, though. Maybe because... he was that crafty about his character. Maybe that's what he saw, though, when he saw the screenings. It wasn't so much the audio, which wasn't great, apparently, and they did fix it as the screenings went on and time went on. But maybe it was more a matter of, I look that dumb. There's a scene about this, again, in Easy Rider's Raging Bulls, where Beatty wanted to shoot the scene where he's talking to himself and pouring some booze. One of the less important scenes where he's by himself. I don't think it's that scene when he's talking as if it's to Mrs. Miller. If it was that scene, Beatty's right, if it took that many takes. But I don't think it was that scene. And he wanted to do more, and it was getting late, and Altman said... fine, you want to do that. Altman didn't like to do a ton of takes, and Beatty did. So he said, I'll go home and my assistant will take care of this. And apparently Beatty shot a lot of takes. And then, of course, the director in the end is going to use whatever take he wants to. So you might be wasting your time. The revenge was when Beatty is out there doing that scene in the snow towards the end. A lot of it, which was legitimate. I'm sure some of it was made. Well, when the wind is just blasting him right in the face, that's probably a jet engine, which they do on sets a lot of time. Or one of those giant fans, at least, blowing snow in his face, legit and otherwise. And that was when Bob apparently said, okay, Warren, we're going to do this again. We didn't quite get it. Oh, the focus wasn't good on that one. The framing was just a little bit off, and he apparently did all kinds of takes on that. But if Beatty's consistent, he would say, okay, whatever it takes to get the movie right. I like Beatty's logic, though, in Easy Rider's Raging Bulls, where apparently he said, we're all here. We paid all this money to be here. The sets have been built, the costumes. What's the harm in doing a bunch of takes if it's going to make the movie better? Fair. So what I've always said about Daniel Day-Lewis, that whole, you have to call me Mr. President when I play Mr. Lincoln, or you have to call me the name of my character. Jesus, you're an actor! But if it makes the movie better, Chris and I got through talking about this with Gloria Rhode. The coach has to coach different players differently. Well, directors are the same. Obviously, Julie Christie didn't need a ton of help, I'm guessing, from her director, but maybe Beatty did. Maybe Beatty wanted to hash out every little small little point. I'm guessing Daniel Day-Lewis does with his directors, too. So whatever makes the movie better, Altman generally loved his actors, and maybe he and Beatty were fine for a while until it just became too much. But if they don't like each other now, of course, Altman's long dead now, and Beatty's still going. But if they had a problem all those years, they should both look back. I think Altman did. Altman's the one who said that he thinks it's Beatty's best work.
And whatever Altman's methods are, he gets natural performances out of his actors. He creates worlds that feel documentary realistic in a way that so few directors ever can. But to anybody who likes this movie, I've got to take this opportunity to recommend First Cow, a movie that is definitely a child of McCabe and Mrs. Miller. Do you know the director's name off the top of your head?
Isn't it Lynn Ramsey?
Is that it? And she also directed...
Kelly Reichert.
Kelly Reichert, okay. She also directed Meek's Cut Off. She creates these really naturalistic, very believable worlds of frontier pioneer life. Both of those movies.
You are there with her
you
movies, too.
You are there! It feels so real, and it paints this really beautiful but also heartbreaking picture of that time and place. And if you like this movie at all, I can't recommend those movies highly enough, but especially First Cow. I loved Meek's Cut Off, but it is bleak. It is Bleak's Cut Off. First Cow also has its sad moments, but it is a more accessible film, a little more cheerful.
The other actors, most of them worked with Altman more than once. René Auberjonois, John Shuck is the dentist in MASH, the Klingon ambassador in the Star Trek flicks as well. William Devane, didn't work with Altman again that I could see. He's the talkie lawyer. Big time role in Knots Landing. He's also an Interstellar in some role. I don't know what it was, but he was in that movie. Shelley Duvall, we didn't mention her at all. She's one of the prostitutes in this, but she was married to a guy, Bart Coyle, who dies. There's a touch in this movie I like a lot. Bart Coyle's funeral happens around the same time, I think the same moment, at least in the editing, that McCabe finds out that Sears has left town. So a funeral has happened, and that foreshadows that McCabe's funeral is going to happen soon, too. McCabe doesn't know that at that point. Well, maybe he does. And he should know it, because Bart Coyle dies for a separate reason, and then Ida, Shelley Duvall, becomes one of Mrs. Miller's many prostitutes.
Yeah, I think that was my favorite B story. Ida's whole arc, which just seems to happen in the background, and we're vaguely aware of it. There's only one scene where she seems to have a voice and talk at all, and that's when Mrs. Miller is trying to just talk her through having sex with strangers. It's just like you did with Bart, but this time you get to keep a little bit of the money. And there's this beautiful, wordless scene at the funeral where Ida and Constance lock eyes. Because Ida, without husband, in this town in the middle of nowhere, what options does she have? She looks at Constance and Constance looks at her. You know that they both know, just like everybody else there knows, that the only place she can go is to the brothel.
And of course, she is memorable in The Shining, also in Nashville, very key role there, as were Carradine and Murphy, who are pretty important supporting parts of this movie. And this was Keith Carradine's debut in movies, too. And he's so young and cute.
He really is.
With all when we did MASH in Nashville so long ago, we'll cover The Player next year, I promise you. Not that you have to twist my arm. I want to cover that movie, too. We'll wait till it's 30 years old next year, though. Why not? Altman's known for zooms and widescreen. This movie is 2:40:1, usually shot the 2:35-ish ratio. He wrote it with Brian McKay, who's doing his only movie script in this case. He did a lot of TV stuff, but Altman wrote a lot of his own movies, or at least co-wrote them. And they based it on Edmund Naughton's 1959 book just called McCabe. And the producers were David Foster. This was his first movie as a producer. Did The Thing, which we covered many years ago. Who doesn't love The Thing? Anybody who loves horror films and sci-fi and stuff. And Mitchell Brower, who worked on The Getaway the next year, the Steve McQueen version, not the more recent one with, well, not that recent now, I guess, but Baldwin and Basinger one. We mentioned Wilmuth Zsigmond shot it. Like the look or not, it was nominated for some awards. I thought it was good. It was so different. Again, one of the many things about this movie, it's not the typical Western. The editor, Altman, threw under the bus a little bit, was Lou Lombardo, who did cut The Wild Bunch, and others for Altman and Peckinpah. So he worked with some tough, irascible directors. He must have been a tough guy himself to deal with those guys. And we said, of course, Leonard Cohen didn't even write the songs for this. They were just chosen for the movie. He didn't like it at first, but then I guess he saw it with an audience and changed his mind. I don't know why an audience would change his mind. If they're in the background, McCabe gets shot and then shoots another guy. Yeah! You know what, Bob? I was wrong.
I feel like when you're involved in a piece of work like this, your brain really does go to a different place watching with an audience than it does on its own. One of the best pieces of advice I ever got when I was first starting out is when you're not sure of a cut, show it to your mom. It doesn't matter what your mom says about it. What matters is that you will truly watch it differently when you're just in the room with your mom, seeing it through her eyes.
Yeah.
So I can see how that's possible. We haven't really talked about Leonard Cohen that much, which is probably the other big Canadian connection, because he's a Canadian musician. And it's funny, I recognize his style, but his voice sounds so dramatically different.
From the Everybody Knows.
Yeah, like Leonard Cohen, as I know him, is 90s Leonard Cohen with that deep baritone
voice.
Everybody
Knows.
And he sounds so different here, but I always find him the most interesting musician because he says he only became a musician because he was a poet, and he was like, nobody reads poetry, but they'll listen to it if you put it in a song.
He's got poetry in him, damn it.
He's got poetry in him. The song is not my favorite way of music that's been used. I think in the 70s, it was still fresh from The Graduate and that style of inserting a song here and there in a movie. It felt still like they hadn't quite perfected that method of inserting songs into a movie.
American Graffiti would do that 2 years after this.
American Graffiti did a much, much better job. It's all songs coming from their radios.
Supposedly,
and stuff. It's so well done. Easy Rider does it too, in I think a little more graceful way than this movie does, but you can't deny that the songs are wonderful and emotionally what it brings to the film.
They fit.
The mood. Yeah, the mood really fits well.
Okay then, McCabe and Mrs. Miller. We haven't covered Altman in so long. We get to one of his better movies, one of his great movies. He is one of my favorite filmmakers. I don't know why we took so long to get back to one of his great films. And this movie, we should have done it in at least March as we have, because it's probably still winter when we release this in mid-March. And this
in
movie,
Canada, it is at least.
Yeah, well, it could be warm for all we know, but I don't know. It's probably not that warm yet. And this movie is definitely very chilly feeling, the ending especially, but the whole movie has that cold umbrella over it. The rain as well, the wind, like we said earlier, really puts you in the time and place. So your last thoughts on McCabe and Mrs. Miller?
I think it's an underseen classic, and in my humble opinion, a far superior film to MASH, which is the Altman film that was honored with a spot on AFI's Top 100.
We talked on MASH about how the women are treated so badly, especially Hot Lips. So sexist that movie is, at least the characters are towards her, and you could argue the movie is towards her and the other women characters. But in this movie, and certainly in Nashville, Altman's not at all sexist, so
no,
either he picked and chose, and maybe he realized, well, this is the movie I gotta put out there, and this movie needs to be about sexist assholes in the Vietnam War. But in McCabe and Mrs. Miller, they do treat some of the prostitutes a little bit badly. We see that early on, but for the most part, they don't seem to be treated
badly.
They
literally buy and sell women. I always say that showing misogyny is not the same as condoning misogyny. I think that MASH condones misogyny, and McCabe and Mrs. Miller is just showing misogyny.
And McCabe does, whether it's because of his pocketbook or because of his sense as a human being, stop what the guy's trying to do to that prostitute in that moment when the guy's beating on her or attacking or whatever you want to call it. They're fighting.
But he buys them like cattle. He's a slave trader. Do those women have an option? But again, they're illustrating a time and place. Did that actually happen in the frontier? Maybe it did. That doesn't mean that it's a misogynistic movie, the way that MASH turned my stomach.
And Nashville makes the women some of the best characters
Absolutely.
In any Altman movie.
Yeah.
And Julie Christie is certainly one of the better ones, too. Even if, much like so much of the audio in this movie, she's hard to understand. But a strong performance by her, Beatty, and the rest. Okay, in 7 days, we'll lighten the mood and get out of the mud and snow as we chat about Reese Witherspoon and perhaps her signature role as Elle Woods in Legally Blonde. The coming attraction's opinion question for Legally Blonde. How do you prefer your Reese in prestige films like Walk the Line and Wild, in her badass run in the 90s with Freeway, Pleasantville, and Election, or in rom-coms like Sweet Home Alabama, Just Like Heaven, and Legally Blonde?
All right, so for our answers to that question, please check out next week's podcast about Legally Blonde. And you can also check out our website in the meantime, top100project.com. You can favorite or subscribe to the Top 100 Project wherever you listen. All our episodes are available for free. That includes all 123 movies that made the AFI's 1998 and or 2007 list of the best American films ever made. But lots more titles on top of that. We've been doing this for years, folks. Like Ryan said, 385 episodes. If you're a fan, why don't you let us know by leaving us a rating and a review. We're both on Twitter. I'm at BevEllisEllis, and Ryan is at MovieFiend51. Our email address is top100projectpodcast@gmail.com. And to enjoy freshly roasted premium coffee delivered straight to you in Canada or the US, please go to sparkplugcoffee.com and use the promo code TOP100PROJECT. And that's all one word, TOP100PROJECT. It's not case sensitive, and that will get you a 20% discount.
Money and pain, Bev. Money and pain.
That's what I cost you?
You're freezing my soul. But I got poetry in me. Poetry.
And cut.
Poetry. Yeah, I'm just going to mutter here by myself and say things. And maybe the mic will pick it up and maybe it won't. And who knows if it does. I don't know.